on behalf of defendant appellant Stevenson Chevrolet. There are, as the court is aware, multiple issues raised in the brief, and given the time constraints, even with the additional 5 minutes, I'm not going to be able to address all of them. We're not waiving any of those issues. For purposes of the oral argument, at least initially, I want to focus on the trial court's pretrial rulings, on the spoliation instruction that was given by the trial court, and by the trial court's failure to give the presumption of negligence jury instruction. This is a unique case in the sense that plaintiff Kober conducted a pre-suit inspection of the vehicle that was run into by defendant Barkley, but plaintiff Coburn did not disclose the results of that investigation until over 1 year after the litigation had been filed. That investigation revealed physical evidence which refuted the assumption that the parties had been operating under up until the disclosure of that evidence, i.e. that the vehicle had run out of gas and stopped on Interstate 70. The first group of issues revolves around the trial court's rulings on three pretrial motions that flowed from the late disclosure. The first was a motion for a short extension of time to submit expert reports based on that disclosure. The second was a motion for continuance of the trial date following the trial court's denial of the motion for an extension of time. And the third was a motion to designate a non-party at fault based on the apparent defect in the vehicle flowing from the late disclosure.
Mr. Gregory, how do you get around the fundamental problem that I see, that your client could have at any time inspected the vehicle as much as it wanted to, could have done anything it wanted to the vehicle, and yet it didn't, and then your client is the one that apparently acquiesced in the vehicle's destruction?
Okay, that's a complicated and multi-parted question, Your Honor. We can't dispute that Stevenson did not inspect the vehicle. And the reason behind that was because everybody was operating on the assumption that the vehicle had run out of gas. So in many respects, I would contend it's somewhat of a red herring to focus on what Stevenson didn't do. That's a factor, but the issue here is whether the trial court abused its discretion in its rulings in not considering the failure of the plaintiff to disclose in a timely manner the evidence of the inspection that it did conduct, which served to rebut that assumption that the parties were acting under.
Well, but if, as you say, all the parties were acting under this particular assumption, yet we have one of the parties going out to make an inspection. And again, what precluded, if anything, Stevenson from doing similarly? Why would Stevenson simply assume a particular cause of an automobile accident without acting responsibly and doing an inspection of the vehicle that it had on its lot?
I don't have a good answer for that, Your Honor. Stevenson could have inspected the vehicle. The statements that were made at the time of the accident by the sales agent were to the effect that the car had run out of gas. So everybody was operating under that assumption until plaintiff Coburn's mechanical engineer came out and inspected that vehicle.
But didn't Coburn make a statement to the effect that at the time of the accident, he neither saw nor heard the low fuel warning?
He made that statement, but he also made the statement at trial that he looked down and he thought the gauge was on empty.
But didn't your client get a written statement from Mr. Coburn way before trial to the effect that he did not either see or hear the low fuel warning?
He did get that statement,
Wouldn't that, at a minimum, have put your client on some type of notice? Well, maybe we should look at the car?
Well, but see, at that point, the car was already gone. The inspection happened pre-litigation. The accident occurred in December of 2009, and the inspection took place in July of 2010. Suit was not filed until December of 2010. And the car was removed from Stevenson's possession after the inspection in July of 2010. So by that time, the car was gone.
And isn't so, excuse me.
Yes.
Isn't that your client's problem? Because your client had received the letter. Please don't, please maintain this evidence. Do not destroy it.
They did receive that letter, and that letter also requested the opportunity to inspect, which was in fact given. And then there was no further request at that point by the mechanical engineer to retain the vehicle. He was specifically asked.
How long after the inspection was it destroyed?
I'm not sure, frankly, that it was ever, quote, destroyed, Judge Miller, but the vehicle left the possession of that storage lot within a day or two after the inspection.
So that you gave them, in other words, your client gave them a day or two in which to say, please hang on to this evidence.
The inspection took place, and then the vehicle was gotten rid of within a couple of days, yes.
So I want to understand the timing.
Yeah.
I know that the vehicle was on Stevenson's lot for a short period of time, perhaps a month or a week.
That's correct.
But then it went to another lot, and Stevenson had access to the vehicle at that point. Is that correct?
It did.
Okay. Now, in terms of the timing of the vehicle being, I guess what we'll call lost for good, and the receipt of the disclosure that Judge Berger referred to, what's the timing there?
Right. The vehicle was inspected by Mr. Kim on July 13th of 2010, and he took video and photographs of the vehicle at that point. On July 14th, the vehicle was sold at auction and left the Impact Auto Auction lot. It wasn't until, and this gets a little fuzzy, it wasn't until January or February of 2012 that the results of that inspection were in fact disclosed by Plaintiff Coburn. And the reason that I say it was a little bit fuzzy is as follows. The existence of the video and the photographs was in fact disclosed on January 23rd of 2012. Plaintiff Coburn indicated that they would make those available, but only if the parties agreed that they were subject to work product protection. And Stevenson, through its counsel, contemplated on that, and it wasn't until February 23rd that Stevenson actually acquiesced in that condition on the production of those documents.
But I'm not so much concerned about that disclosure. I'm talking about the disclosure that Judge Berger was referring to, the statement from the plaintiff that he had not seen the fuel light or heard any fuel warning. When did that statement get to you or your client?
I believe that would have been, I don't know the precise date, it would have been in 2011.
Okay, so that would have been after the vehicle was lost.
Long after the vehicle was lost,
okay.
Yes.
Now, but before the vehicle was lost, you received this letter asking that the vehicle be preserved as evidence in the case. I'm just curious as to why you think that it was okay for Stevenson to get rid of the vehicle immediately after it was inspected. I mean, it remained evidence in the case even after it was inspected.
It did. And I can't give you a reason other than the fact that they were continuing to maintain the vehicle and having to pay the fees to maintain the vehicle at that lot. And they believe that following the inspection, that they could then dispose of the vehicle. That's the best explanation that I can give you for their conduct. But we then come back to, as I was saying, the argument being that we have to, or we're at least arguing, that in terms of the trial court's rulings, you also have to focus on the fact that Coburn did not disclose these documents until well over a year after litigation had been filed, and that changed the complexion of the case at that point in time because it gave rise to a new theory as to why the vehicle had stopped, i.e. it was a mechanical error rather than running out of gas. And so it was at that point that Stevenson moved for a short extension of time to submit an expert report from Mr. Ogden, which discussed his review of those documents and his opinions concerning why the vehicle would have stopped, assuming that it had not run out of gas.
But it wouldn't have really been a short extension, would it have? Because if you had been permitted to designate General Motors as a non-party at fault, it totally changed the complexion of the case and would have required extensive additional discovery and an extensive continuance. Am I missing something there?
You're not missing anything. I do believe that it would have really changed the complexion of the case. But ultimately, this court has held numerous times, as had the Supreme Court, that the goal of cases and trials, it's supposed to be a search for the truth and a resolution on the merits rather than on a procedural basis is a favored approach. And this is a unique situation in the sense that plaintiff discovered evidence which actually was unfavorable to it and favorable to Stevenson and didn't disclose it in a timely manner.
Counsel?
Yes.
Isn't there evidence or some indication in the record that there were people who had to start the vehicle while it was in the storage lots? Well, if the car had run out of gas, then for people to be able to do that, somebody would have had to put some gas in it, I presume.
No, they turned the, I'm not a mechanic, they turned the accessory switch on. They hooked a remote battery supply to it and turned the accessory switch on, which brought up the instruments.
Okay, so it wasn't...
It wasn't firing up of the vehicle.
Okay, so the engine was not running.
Right. Okay. And it showed between 1/8 and empty in terms of gas in the tank,
right,
is what that showed.
All right, but that might just be... I mean, this is all speculation. That could just be a problem with the gauge. It could still be empty, right? We don't know.
But that creates at least a fact question, because certainly it was showing more than empty, and the light was not on. The out of fuel light was not on at that point in time.
You were able to argue to the jury, though, that something caused the accident other than lack of fuel, right?
That's correct.
Because the judge, over Colburn's objection, admitted the photo of the gas gauge?
That's correct.
And so what else would have, assuming you were able to get an expert,
right,
at that time the car was no longer available for whatever reason, what could the expert meaningfully have said?
The expert could have opined that given that evidence, it was not the fault of Stevenson that the car stopped, but rather it was a mechanical defect that caused the car to stop, and thus Stevenson was not negligent.
How would the expert have been able to do that? The expert would have had to speculate. He would have had to assume that Stevenson did absolutely nothing to the vehicle while it was in its possession.
But that could have been, or that would have been, an issue to be, I guess, argued in front of the judge, but all of that was precluded by the pretrial rulings. As to, you know, it may well be that the judge would have determined that that opinion was speculative, but we never got there. We were never allowed to get an expert and introduce that opinion.
But it seems that the opinion wouldn't have merely been speculative, it would have been untestable. The car was gone. I mean, I can't see a judge allowing an expert opinion and that's simply completely unverifiable.
Unverifiable except to the extent that there was evidence as to what the gauges showed. And that evidence certainly could have been tested through cross-examination. And these issues could have been raised at trial through cross-examination. But, you know, the expert was precluded totally.
Did the expert make an offer of proof of what opinions he would reach?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that his opinion was submitted to the judge in advance of the hearing on the motion for reconsideration of the denial of the motion for extension of time to submit an expert report.
And that was essentially what would have been his report that he would have relied on at trial.
Exactly.
And what were his opinions?
I believe, as I recall, his opinions were that there was a mechanical, or that at least the evidence showed that the reason the car stopped was not because that it had run out of fuel, but it must have been some other reason.
But you argued that, and you had physical or photographic evidence of that point that actually was presented to the jury.
There's no question that there was that evidence that was presented. What was missing is the ability to present it through an expert who would give testimony as to the basis for his opinions.
But his opinion would have been that he looked at the photo and it said it was 1/8, right?
Correct.
Do you really need an expert to do that?
Well, if you're dealing with the mechanical issue of why the vehicle stopped, yes.
But isn't the problem, or at least one of the problems, that had the expert been allowed to so testify, the plaintiffs would have been disadvantaged is not strong enough. They had no way to rebut that particular opinion because they couldn't test the vehicle because Stevenson let it go.
And that kind of goes to the spoliation instruction issue. I mean, and that is, we have two separate settings here, Judge Jones. We have a situation where, in fact, Coburn has, in fact, been given the opportunity to conduct an inspection of the vehicle. And if you look at the Castillo versus Chief alternative case, one of the things that this court focuses on there in whether a spoliation instruction should be given is whether there was an opportunity to examine the evidence in question before it was destroyed. And I would point out to the court Castillo's reliance on a New York case called Thiel versus Addies Auto and Marine. That was a situation where a boat was inspected a number of times and then the boat was disposed of. And in refusing the request to give a spoliation instruction there, the New York court focused on the fact that there was an opportunity and had been an opportunity to inspect, and that the issues dealing with the destruction of the boat could be dealt with through cross-examination and argument, but it didn't warrant given the spoliation instruction.
Does the record reflect whether Barclay had any knowledge of the existence of the photograph of the fuel gauge before it was finally produced?
No, the record does not reflect that, and also the record does not reflect that Barclay at any point, either pre-suit or during suit, requested an inspection of the suit.
So wouldn't that fact support the exercise of the discretion by the trial judge to deny all of the motions that you're complaining about now?
I don't think so, because if we look at the Castillo case, one of the factors that can be taken into consideration is whether a party actually asked to inspect. And here, Barclay never asked to inspect. I want to, since I'm running out of time, I want to go to one other issue, if I might, and that is the failure of the trial court to give the presumption of negligence instruction on a rear-end accident. If you look at the record, and I'm going to run real short here, but if you look at the record, the trial court refused to give that instruction, stating that it was ridiculous and nonsensical. And those are the pattern instructions approved by the Supreme Court through its opinions. The trial court never ruled that the facts of this case didn't warrant the giving of that instruction vis-a-vis Barclay running into the back of Coburn. And if we look at the cases support that that instruction should have been given here because Coburn was, albeit stopped in traffic, he was legitimately stopped because of an emergency and Barclay ran into him from the rear.
But he wasn't legitimately stopped. he was stopped because of someone's negligence, right?
Well,
if the lack of fuel caused the car to stop. So when you say he was legitimately stopped, isn't it different than if I'm stopped at a traffic light, I'm legally stopped there, and someone plows into me? Isn't this different?
I don't think... May I answer?
Sure.
Okay. I don't think
so. To Judge Jones.
Okay. Of course. Boss, can I answer?
Of course.
Okay. I think it's different, and the reason is we're not dealing with a situation where somebody volitionally stopped the car and abandoned it and walked away. And there are those cases, and the court would hold, you don't get the presumption of negligence instruction in that setting. But here, there was, if you will, an emergency of some making that caused the car to stop in a through lane of traffic. And so he was legitimately there. He hadn't made a volitional choice to stop and abandon the car. It was there, and it got hit from the rear. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon. If it pleases the court, I'm Roger Castle. I represent Mr. Barkley. I also will be speaking today on behalf of the defendant, Lutheran Social Services, whose counsel will not argue. My registration number is 7621. First, I want to address this spoliation instruction. That instruction was well within the discretion of the court. This isn't a de novo question of whether the court properly applied the law or spoke the law. It's a question of whether this instruction was appropriate for the circumstances of the case, and that's a discretionary decision by the trial court. In this case, all the elements were met for the giving of a spoliation instruction, and the mildest form of spoliation instruction was given. The you may infer, rather it is presumed, or you shall, or you must infer. And so the question is, does it apply here? And the legal question of whether a spoliation instruction should be given is focused on what information does the evidence possessing party know at the time that they dispose of the car? And there's two criteria. One, do you know that the evidence is relevant? And two, can you foresee that there's going to be litigation? In this case, Stevenson doesn't really even debate either of those elements because it's obvious. It was relevant, and they had a letter from Mr. Colburn's counsel saying, we intend to pursue litigation and we want you to preserve the evidence. They specifically told them, and then as an afterthought, at the end of that letter, they said, we would like to inspect. But the first thing they said, we need you to preserve this evidence in a future legal action. Now, so what does Stevenson argue in its briefs in light of the fact that those elements are met? They say, well, there must be a new prerequisite here. You should, as the Court of Appeals, impose a new prerequisite. And that new prerequisite is that each party to the litigation must expressly and repeatedly ask for preservation. That's their argument. Now, there's no law that required that Colburn ask for preservation, but he did. The fact that Colburn asked for it is only relevant to the extent that it puts Stevenson on notice, who has the evidence, to keep the evidence. That's the reason that the request is important. When other courts' opinions, including courts in Colorado, have talked about this issue of spoliation, and they mention that a party requested it, they do it not because the party had to request it, but because that request put the evidence-holding party on notice. Now,
Is it necessary to place the party on notice?
I don't believe so, no, because the criteria are, do you know that there's foreseeable litigation, and do you know the evidence is relevant? And if you know those two things, then that's sufficient for the spoliation. It's just that the request enhances your not clear notice of those two things. Here, Stevenson had control of the evidence, they had notice of the potential litigation. The general manager of Stevenson even said he was expecting these claims to be coming down, and he's the one that personally released the vehicle to be disposed of. Next, Stevenson admits that when it disposed of the car, it believed that the evidence of the car would have proved that the car ran out of gas.
Excuse me, Mr. Castle.
Yes.
The testimony by the general manager that you just referred to, that he expected litigation, is that trial testimony?
Yes, it was a deposition that was presented to the court in the pretrial rulings, but then that videotaped deposition was played in lieu of evidence at the time of trial. So it's both.
Thank you.
And when the car, so when Stevenson disposed of the car, they admittedly believed that if the evidence was inspected, tested, disassembled, that it was going to be adverse to their interests. So they already admitted that they knew at that time that they disposed of it, that it was adverse to their interests. So the court, faced with this information, the trial court observed that the need for and the propriety of the exfoliation instruction was enhanced and necessitated by the very fact that then 3 months prior to trial, for the first time, Stevenson was trying to reverse its position on what caused the accident. And it then obtained admission of that, those photographic evidence that Coburn had taken, and argued an alternative mechanical cause of the stall long after it had disposed of the vehicle. Stevenson in his brief, and one last comment on this issue, Stevenson in his brief points and almost relies solely on the Castillo case, Castillo versus Chief. And what is very important is that the facts of the Castillo case are not only significantly different, but I'm not going to parse those facts. The key important distinction of the Castillo case is that Castillo did not say that it was reversible error to give a spoliation instruction in the Castillo circumstances. What Castillo said is that it was not an abuse of discretion. It was not arbitrary or unreasonable for the court to not give a spoliation instruction in Castillo. So you can't rely on Castillo to say it was wrong for this trial judge to give this spoliation instruction. One last comment on that. They mentioned that in the reply brief, they mentioned that Mr. Barclay said at that time, a month after the accident, he didn't have plans to sue. Keep in mind that is a complete red herring, because he didn't communicate that information to Stevenson. Stevenson didn't know anything about that. That information was in a private conversation between him and Coburn when Coburn called him up and asked if he wanted to team up with him in a claim against Stevenson. And Mr. Barclay, a month after the accident, says, I'm not thinking right now about litigation. I'm thinking about getting better. That's the context of his statement, and they never knew about it, so it can't have affected. In Castillo, the court pointed out that Castillo didn't ask for the preservation because in Castillo, the plaintiff had told the evidence-holding person, I'm not going to sue, and then they disposed of it. That's a completely different situation. Next, let me turn my attention to the rear-end instruction. Stevenson's brief, I believe, unfairly characterizes the trial court's comments about this instruction. This doesn't involve an error of law. Again, it's a discretion with the trial court about whether to give the instruction. What the trial court said was, this instruction doesn't make sense. It's nonsensical in these particular circumstances. That was the exact words of the trial court. And that's not the trial court saying the Supreme Court doesn't know what they're talking about in making this instruction. It said the trial court was merely observing that it didn't make sense to apply here. Now, why would the court decide that? Because of the facts of what happened. There was a car stopped dead in the fast lane of interstate while all the other traffic was going 65, 70 miles an hour. And it didn't move over. The evidence, most of the evidence, said it ran out of gas, and it didn't move over to the shoulder when it ran out of gas. And Mr. Barkley comes up the road in the fast lane. He's following a large work truck. He's driving at a safe distance behind that work truck when, on a curve, suddenly the truck swerves into the other lane and slows down and leaves Mr. Barkley facing a car stopped dead in his lane, and he can't swerve like the trucks were because the truck had slowed down and blocked him in, and so he's pinned in between the guardrail on I-70 and the truck that's on the right. The trooper, the state trooper, testified at trial that Mr. Barkley was not at fault. Now, the instructions in this case that were given fully and adequately advised the jury of what the law was that governed their decision, and that is negligence, defined as reasonable care. And that instruction was applied equally to all of the parties. And that's what the court decided. The court did not want to single out one party for emphasis in the instructions. So the court gave the general negligence and reasonable care instructions and then let all the parties argue for that. The court declined to give several negligence per se instructions about statutory duties to not stop in the roadway, to not impede the traffic, to minimum speed on the interstate, a whole bunch of instructions on that. The court also declined to give the duty to inquire instruction, which would have sort of pointed the finger at Coburn and Stevenson about not noticing that the car was low on gas, because the court said, I want to be even-handed. And that's exactly what the court was intending to do, is comply with the Kruger case that's cited in the briefs to try to make it so that the court is not singling out any party for emphasis. I would also argue that that instruction was harmless error anyway, because first of all, it's safe to assume that virtually every juror is a driver, and every juror has a concept that if you rear end somebody, it looks bad for you. And I don't think they need the court to tell them that important thing just in conceptually. Secondly, the instruction, if it had been given, didn't tell the jury they had to find Mr. Barkley at fault. It just says that there is a presumption if you're following too closely. The last thing is that the jury heard all the facts. They heard Coburn's arguments. They heard Stevenson's arguments. And they found, the jury found, Mr. Barkley 0%. I think that's far more of an indication that it's harmless error than any indication that there was prejudice there. Next, I'll turn my attention to the expert issue, which you obviously understand and have carefully looked at, but I want to make a couple of points on that. The court carefully considered, the trial court carefully considered Stevenson's interests. It even expressly stated that it considered Stevenson's interests, and it expressly stated in its order that it considered Stevenson's expert's affidavit. And there was certainly no abuse, because in this case, the court was trying to balance everybody's interest. And in this case, the court allowed all this evidence in over our objection. The court allowed evidence of these photographs. The court allowed Stevenson to argue that this meant that there was an alternative cause, an alternative reason for the stall. And Stevenson argued that aggressively. And so the other thing that's important is that Stevenson was never denied any discovery on this issue. if you read the briefs, it sounds like because there was no continuance and there was no expert, somehow they were denied discovery. The reality is they took depositions, multiple depositions, on this issue of the evidence and the preservation.
Mr. Castle, I know you don't represent Colbert. Is that you represent Barclays? Is that
yes,
right?
That's correct.
So maybe I shouldn't be asking you this question, but didn't Colbert get a free pass for improperly withholding the photographs of the dashboard?
Oh, I'll be happy. I have an opinion and an argument on that. So, absolutely. First of all, I don't believe that you can say they got a free pass because Stevenson never asked for any sanctions or any kind of penalty. They said, we're not blaming anybody and we're not asking for sanctions. So to say they got a free pass is not exactly accurate. But should they have disclosed earlier? My view is that they did not improperly delay in disclosing the evidence. And the reason why is the only evidence was photographs taken by a member of their law firm, an employee of their law firm. I believe that is facially attorney work product. But why did they disclose it? They voluntarily disclosed it on their own initiative, on their own decision, without anybody asking them to or anybody even raising the issue. And they did it because when they found out that the vehicle had been destroyed, it was lost, the evidence had not been preserved by Stevenson, they apparently made, that's what the record says, that the trial counsel for Colbert said, in these circumstances, I believe I should give up the evidence because it's the only evidence that now still exists in light of the fact that the vehicle has been destroyed. Lastly, remember, Stevenson knew about the inspection all along. They arranged for it and knew about it and participated in the arrangements for the inspection, so it wasn't new news to them that there was an inspection.
But, counsel, there was no listing of any documents coming from that investigation, was there?
Not until January 23rd, when they decided that the vehicle was disposed and they should disclose the photographs.
But they didn't disclose it on a privilege log, as they would have been required to, did they? They didn't list it on a privilege log, did they?
And that's part of what the court was weighing, is that the court was concerned that this is a complete surprise to Barclay and Lutheran. We never heard of any that had even been inspected before. So the court's trying to weigh the interests of everybody. One last comment. We continue to believe, as I said at the very end of my brief, that this appeal should have been dismissed. And the reason why I say that is that, respectfully, I don't believe that this court can, under Rule 11D, extend the time for filing of the record 6 weeks after the due date has passed. We argued that in briefs, and Judge Davidson, without deciding the issues, denied the motion to dismiss. But I don't believe that the court has jurisdiction because I think Rule 11 makes it very clear that you must ask for an extension for filing the record before the record is due. And if you wait until afterwards, the Supreme Court of Colorado has on multiple occasions decided that you can't extend after the fact.
May it please the court, I'm Anna Dearest. I am counsel on behalf of plaintiff Kelly Coburn, and my registration number is 36147. The most important fact with respect to the issues that we've mostly been addressing today is that Stevenson destroyed the only evidence that could rebut its new mechanical defect theory that they brought out 3 months before the trial began. They did this in the face of a preservation letter that was clear that Mr. Coburn was contemplating filing litigation. And to address your question earlier, the letter that was sent doesn't say, please hold the vehicle until the inspection is over. It says, please hold the vehicle because there's pending litigation and this is very important evidence. And then it also requested an inspection. The reason we requested an inspection, we always inspect the vehicles to document the evidence. In this case, we did that to document the evidence that this vehicle ran out of gas, which is the only evidence that came in through trial.
How do you justify not putting the photograph at least on the privilege log, setting aside the argument as to whether it's proper work product to begin with, which apparently the judge disagreed with you on that, but how do you justify not even listing it on the privilege log?
Your Honor, I don't know why that they were not listed on the privilege log. Perhaps they should have been. But the real issue is that the fact that there was no privilege log makes no difference at all to this appeal, makes no difference at all to Stevenson, because Stevenson knew that these photographs and these inspection videos existed because they set up the inspection and they allowed us to do the inspection. They never requested those videos or the plaintiff voluntarily disclosed those. There was no motion, there was no argument about that. When we independently verified that the vehicle had been disposed, importantly, they disposed of the vehicle without even providing Coburn notice. We did not know until almost a year and a half later that the vehicle no longer existed. At that point, we immediately disclosed those documents because at that point we knew that none of the other parties could go look at the evidence because Stevenson had already destroyed it.
If the photographs had been listed, there might have been earlier litigation over whether or not that was truly work product, and it might have all happened before the document was, the vehicle was destroyed. Isn't that a possibility?
And that wouldn't have happened before the vehicle was destroyed because the vehicle was destroyed literally the day after our engineer went out and inspected the vehicle. That was prior to filing of the litigation. It was about 6 months prior to that filing, and so we had, you know, no litigation in which to file a privilege log at that point. So Stevenson's immediate disposal of that vehicle after our inspection precluded any effect. Nothing else? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course.